Laura, Dad, Mommy, I'm all glad that you're here. I've been meaning to talk to you, sort of a family conversation about all these calls and articles for me to not bomb Afghanistan during Ramadan.
Well, Sana, of course, it's your decision. I'd just like to say that if you stop bombing, I think it'd be bad.
Bad.
Let me tell you a little story about the Tet Offensive.
Dad, I'd appreciate you not using such language in front of the ladies.
That was Tet Offensive, son. Well, anyway, yeah, if you don't laugh at this stuff, if you don't laugh, the terrorists have already won. You see, son, the Tet, well, that's the Vietnamese New Year.
I knew that. Well, but basically, I think I understand what you're saying. I'm gonna get that guy who did us wrong. The war on terror won't take holidays.
Yeah.
Who dropped the bomb during Ramadan? Who stopped the fun of their fundamental sing-song? Who dropped the food on Jalalalabad? Who dropped the bags full of spam and ham and ding-dongs? The Taliban is gonna hit the fan.
And this won't be another Vietnam.
Yeah.
When my Laura said,
"Hey W, this news is gonna trouble you,"
it was time for taking off the gloves. And when my mom was saying,
"Finish it, kid, don't do like your daddy did,"
now it's time for Bush to come to shove.
So I'll drop a bomb during Ramadan.
He'll stop the fun of their fundamental sing-song.
I'll drop the food on Jalalalabad.
We'll drop the bags full of spam and ham and ding-dongs.
Osama will fail, but he won't go to jail. We'll sentence him to handle U.S. mail.
Home Ramadan, go boom!
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up next, Why Civil Resistance Movements Succeed. Steve Inskeep talks to Erica Chenowitz and Maria Stefan about why nonviolent resistant campaigns work better than armed rebellion.
Right now, there are demonstrations all over the world calling for economic, political, or social change, from protests in Ferguson, Missouri, over police tactics, to marches for and against democracy in Hong Kong. But researcher Maria Stefan admits that recent events have called into question whether such civil resistance is effective.
Obviously, looking around the world today, whether it's Syria, whether it's Iraq, parts of Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, it's hard to be optimistic about civil resistance having, you know, a hopeful future. But I actually think people are also looking at what is happening in these places and thinking to themselves, there has to be a better way.
A better way is what led Stefan and her colleague Erica Chenoweth to study more than 300 cases of resistance from 1900 to 2006 to answer one central question. Are violent rebellions more effective than nonviolent movements? They spoke to our colleague Steve Inskeep about the findings.
When you look back through history, what was the difference in the results between violent tactics and nonviolent tactics? Erica Chenoweth?
Well, when we drilled down into the data, we found that the nonviolent campaigns tend to be 11 times larger than the violent ones. People power is really the main story here. When very large and diverse sectors of society withdraw their cooperation from the opponent government, it's extremely difficult for that government to maintain its hold on control. And the reason is because every power holder is 100% reliant on the cooperation, obedience, and help of people that reside in its pillars of support, the security forces, the state media, religious authorities, educational elites, business and economic elites, and civilian bureaucrats. One of the best kind of concrete examples of how this plays out comes from an anecdote from Serbia, where a nonviolent movement removed Slobodan Milosevic from power in October of 2000. And the last stages of that campaign, where hundreds of thousands of people were engaging in a demonstration in Belgrade, the police were ordered to shoot live ammunition into the crowd indiscriminately. and they just stood there in silence. They didn't retreat, they didn't join into the protest, but they didn't follow the order. When one of them was asked later why he refused to shoot, he said, "I was afraid my kids would be in the crowd."
You've described how a nonviolent uprising has broader participation, more people, sheer numbers of people. You also write about the types of people who get involved.
Right. So, I mean, nonviolent movements tend to attract the participation of men and women, rich, poor, blue-collar, white-collar workers, religious figures, mainly because there are so many different tactics available to groups that engage in civil resistance. In general, the barriers to participation are lower. So we often see, you know, women being on the front lines of movements. In Tunisia, the People Power movement that ousted Ben Ali, the trade unions played a critical role in launching labor strikes, and then they played a very important role in the peace building that followed. And I think that's an important point to make, that transitions that are driven by active nonviolent means tend to result in societies that are both more democratic and that are less likely to result in civil war after the fact. So they're more peaceful societies as well.
Okay, so Maria Stephan, why does an armed rebellion not put that same kind of pressure on an authoritarian government?
Right, so when you use armed means and violence, it's very hard to co-opt or prompt loyalty shifts within those pillars of support, whether it's security forces or others. And it sort of encourages an even more massive crackdown on the opposition.
I'm thinking of something that I heard traveling in Syria last year. I was talking with a doctor who was willing to say out loud that he had no love at all for Bashar al-Assad. But having said that, he said, these rebels are destroying the country. That's the kind of thing you're talking about. That's the attitude shift that may take place when it becomes an armed rebellion.
Right. So I would say, since I worked with some very brave and courageous Syrians for over a year while with the State Department, and can say that I have great respect for their ability to maintain a nonviolent posture for about 8 or 9 months against this type of regime. So I understand where that doctor is coming from. It's also pretty evident why Syrians took up arms against this type of regime. But the problem with it is that once armed insurgency became the prevailing form of resistance against the Assad regime, this significantly decreased the level of participation. It caused sort of moderate voices, fence sitters, to not be overwhelmingly supportive of the opposition. And then the resistance was very largely reliant on outside forces. So they needed weapons, training, money, which, you know, as we've seen, has been not as forthcoming as they would have hoped.
I'm curious, since your findings have been published, what reaction you've received specifically from military officers. Erica Chenoweth?
Military officers are surprisingly receptive to the findings. They find it intuitive. They tend to like the strategic framework, especially. They ask tough questions, of course, but are generally pretty convinced by the findings.
Likewise. So I would say that one of the prevailing views amongst military colleagues is that, well, you know what, if local people, if the local communities in these countries are able to bring about serious political change themselves, and we don't have to send our guys and women into harm's way, isn't that preferable? Well, of course it is.
What were some of the tough questions you mentioned?
Well, it takes less than 5 Q&As usually to get to the Hitler question, which is, would nonviolent resistance have worked against Hitler? There are these questions about whether there are types of regimes that nonviolent resistance can't work against, and so forth. And we don't exactly know. We know that there were pockets of nonviolent resistance against Hitler's occupations in various places, and they honestly fared better on local levels than any of the partisan or armed uprisings dead around Europe. That is for sure. But I think that we don't yet have a really strong set of empirical findings that suggest that there are places in the world that nonviolent resistance is totally impossible.
You do have, maybe not Hitler, but you do have Syria, where, as you've mentioned, there was an effort at nonviolent resistance for months and months, and the government drove them into armed rebellion.
Right. So Syria, I think our shared analysis is that any form of resistance against this regime was going to have a difficult time. But we do say, perhaps counterintuitively, that nonviolent resistance, if it had had more time, if there had been the ability of the opposition to plan to diversify their tactics for the local resistance, which was actually quite amazing around Syria, to bring their activities together, to coordinate their resistance, it may have had a chance of success. They needed more time against this regime. This regime was very skilled at using the sectarian card and every other means to divide the population. And it responded, of course, to the armed resistance in a terrible way.
Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stephan, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Erica Chenoweth of the University of Denver and Maria Stephan, a dual fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Atlantic Council, speaking with our colleague Steve Inskeep.
I never saw so many business suits. Never knew a dollar sign could look so cute. Never knew a junkie with a money Jones is singing. Who's selling Park Place? Who's buying Boardwalk? These old men, they make their dirty deals. Go in the back room and see what they can steal. Talk about your beautiful for spacious skies. It's about uranium. It's about the water rights. Got Mother Nature on a luncheon plate. They carve her up and call it real estate. Want all the resources and all of the land. They make a war over it, blow things up for it. The reservation out at Poverty Row. There's something cooking and the lights are low. Somebody's trying to save our Mother Earth. I'm gonna help them to save it and sing it and say it. Sing it, no, no, I guess you can't do that. No more, no more, no more. No, 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 I guess you can't do that. No more, no more, no more, no more. No, 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 I guess you can't do that. No more, no more, no more. No, 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 I guess Columbus, he was looking good when he got lost in our neighborhood. Garden of Eden right before his eyes. Now it's all spyware. Now it's all income tax. Oh, brother Midas looking hungry today. What he can't buy, he gets some other way. Send in the troopers if the natives resist. Old, old story, boys. That's how you do it, boys. Look at these people, Lord, they're on a roll. They want it all, they want complete control. Want all the resources and all of the land. They make a war over it, blow things up for it. While all our champions are off in the war. Their final ripoff here at home is on. Mr. Greed, I think your time has come. We're going to sing it and say it and live it and pray it. Sing it, no, no.
Coming up next, the growing threat from methane. Living on Earth, Helen Palmer reports evidence from prehistory suggests methane was a major factor in Earth's largest extinction, and warming projections warn of ballooning emissions in the future.
Every so often, a cluster of stories comes along around the same time that makes you think there must be something in the air, or maybe the water. Well, that's been happening recently, and indeed there is something in the air and in the water, and it's the powerful greenhouse gas, methane. Living on Earth's Helen Palmer has the story.
There's more than twice as much methane in the atmosphere now as there was before the Industrial Revolution. That's thanks to our energy generation, agriculture, and the stuff we throw away. And there's reason we should care. Methane's an extremely powerful greenhouse gas.
Over a 20-year period, it's over 80 times as strong as CO2. Over 100 years, the number is about 34, according to the most recent estimates.
That's Michael Abita, the methane expert at the World Resources Institute. So he welcomes the latest announcement announcement from the White House's Climate Action Plan, new rules to control methane.
Well, it's got a four-pronged approach looking at methane emissions from various sectors. It's going to address emissions from landfills, coal mines, agriculture, and oil and gas development, which are four of the largest sources of methane emissions in the U.S.
Obita says some of the steps the White House laid out have a lot going for them. Take the plans for oil and gas production, for example.
The administration is planning to look at ways to reduce leaks and vents of methane from oil and gas development on public lands. This is an excellent strategy, but it's also among the lowest hanging fruit. Methane is the primary component of natural gas, and so capturing methane allows companies to sell more gas to market.
It's tougher to control methane that escapes from decaying organic garbage, but tapping gas from landfills can generate energy, and that's what the tech firm Apple is doing. The EPA plans to release updated landfill standards this summer, along with voluntary measures to help dairy farmers install methane digesters to generate power from manure. And talk of methane digesters brings us to a second piece of news, MIT research that fingers methane-creating microbes as perhaps a major player in what's called the end Permian extinction. Lead author, MIT geophysicist Daniel Rothman.
It's the biggest extinction in the last 540 million years, which is the length of time over which we have a good understanding of the geologic record.
It was 252 million years ago, and about 90% of all species on Earth were wiped out. Massive volcanoes covered Siberia with some 240,000 cubic miles of magma and launched 10,000 gigatons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But Rothman says after that, the arithmetic on the amount of carbon just didn't add up. Carbon levels kept going up and up and up over time.
We hypothesized that the cause could have been microbial in origin. That is, there are reasons to believe, geochemical reasons to believe, that there was a stockpile of detritus in the oceans. And we asked ourselves, what if a microbe evolved a new ability to consume that detritus?
They went looking for such a microbe and found an archaea, an ancient microbial species called Methanosarcina, that about this time underwent an evolutionary change so it could more efficiently chew up organic matter and produce methane.
So we therefore found a culprit, if you wish, having hypothesized that a microbe could have done it. We then identified the microbe, Methanosarcina. So that led to a date.
And that date is 240 million years ago, plus or minus 40 million years, which conveniently includes the end Permian extinction. Rothman says there's further evidence. Methane-producing microbes need nickel, and the massive volcanic eruptions created huge nickel deposits found in sediments, allowing the Methanosarcina to flourish. The methane they created reacted with seawater to create CO2, which acidified the oceans, explaining another mystery of this extinction.
Researchers before us had noted that animals with heavily calcified shells preferentially went extinct. And that had led them to conclude that the kill mechanism, as they worded it, was ocean acidification. So what we are doing is providing a mechanism for the ocean acidification.
Given current concerns about increasingly acidified oceans, this research from prehistory sounds a warning note for the future. And so does some more research just published in the journal Nature. It examined methane locked up in decomposing organic matter in water sources, such as ponds and wetlands. In 2011, Iowa State ecology professor John Downing told Living on Earth just how much methane is locked up in small ponds and the like.
Well, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around the numbers because they're usually measured in things like petagrams, which is kind of an immense amount of material, but it's equivalent to about 25% of all the carbon that's taken up and sequestered by terrestrial environments worldwide.
As Professor Downing says, that methane's locked up there, but the new Nature paper examines what's likely to happen as these ponds and rice paddies heat up. Analysis of 1,600 measurements across the globe shows that as the temperature rises, more methane escapes. For instance, a rise from 0 to 30 degrees Celsius would create emissions as much as 57 times higher. That's an extreme temperature rise, but possible between winter and a summer heat wave. All biological rates tend to double with each 10 degrees of warming, as MIT's Daniel Rothman puts it.
This is a very good example of a positive feedback in which as the climate warms, the permafrost will melt. Previously frozen organic matter will then be metabolized by methanogens or other microorganisms, which will produce more greenhouse gases, which will then produce more warming, which will then speed up rates even more.
which means that the warnings of both the methane burp associated with the Permian extinction and projections for accelerating methane emissions as ponds and wetlands warm make attempts by the White House to control this potent greenhouse gas escaping to the atmosphere not only prudent, but vital. Michael Abita of the World Resources Institute again.
The next 20 years will be crucial in, you know, ensuring that globally greenhouse gas emissions peak within the next 10 years or so and then start declining pretty significantly if we're going to avoid the worst impacts of climate change.
At the moment, he says, time is not on our side. For Living on Earth, I'm Helen Palmer.
Big business cares about little people. You're getting sleepy. Polar bears are overrated. You're getting sleepy. Fiscal responsibility demands that we ignore the cost of Bush's tax cuts and two wars. Now when I count to three and snap my fingers, you'll awake refreshed and vote Republican. Iran's a threat to peace, so we should bomb them. You're getting sleepy. Elizabeth Warren is too altruistic to be trusted. Sleepy. We called it the Pledge to America because we're simply dusting off a contract with America because that worked so well. And now when I count to three and snap my fingers, you'll awake confused and vote Republican. Mexicans are taking American jobs, which we could be outsourcing to Sri Lanka. Jesus loves America best. That's why he wrote the Bible in English. Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito hate judicial activism, and so they gave all the rights of personhood to Walmart. Now when I count to three and snap my fingers, Republican. Ooh, I want to see Titanic too. Ooh, 'cause I love watching the same disaster over and over. Louis Gohmert will protect us from terror babies. Sleepy. Republicans gave us civil rights. So sleepy. Newt Gingrich should decide who can and cannot be married. Sarah Palin, bring on the rapture. Whatever happens outside my gate is not my problem. I vote Republican. The best social safety net is debtor's prison. So vote Republican. You can't wrap your head around the fact that the footprint of in-transition human capital demonstrates you lack the skill set and bandwidth needed to provide impactful throughput to effectively brand the current failure cascade in the knowledge economy space. And science is confusing. Now when I count to three and snap my fingers, you'll remember nothing. And vote Republican. You're getting sleepy. You're counting sheep and getting sheepy. Lullaby.
Put an end to war. I dreamed I saw a mighty room. The room was full of men, and the paper they were signing said they'd never fight again. And when the paper was all signed and a million copies made, they all joined hands and bowed their heads, and grateful prayers were prayed. And the people in the streets below were dancing round and round, and swords and guns and uniforms were scattered on the ground. Last night I had the strangest dream.
Last night I had the strangest
dream. I never dreamed before. A mighty room. The room was full of men. And the paper they were signing said they'd never fight again.
They'd never fight again.
Last night I had the strangest dream.
Last night I had the strangest dream. I never dreamed before. I dreamed the world had all agreed to put an end to war.
That's all, folks.